Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks, a series of talks by scholars and graduate students on all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. If you'd like to join our network or find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork and like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies. You can also visit our website at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.
Okay, so I think we're ready to start. Just to introduce myself, I'm Phoebe. I'm the president of the Screen Studies Network, who's organised these talks today. I'm going to throw to Professor Megan Morris from the University of Sydney, who's kindly agreed to be our respondent for our speaker today, who is Tim Waring.
Thank you. As you can see, I'm not Jane Park, author of Yellow Futures. I'm Jane's colleague at, what's it called? Gender and Cultural Studies at the University of Sydney. I've known Tim a long time because Tim did his doctoral work there. I'm sure you all know Tim very well. I don't need to introduce you, is that correct? Except that he teaches global cinema at UTS and has written really stunning stuff on popular music and Korean popular culture and transnational issues in film and music. My qualification here briefly is I co-edited a book with Stephen Chan-Ting-Kyu and Lee Siu-Leung called Hong Kong Connections, Transnational Imagination in Action Cinema, and written a huge article also called Transnational Imagination in Action Cinema. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing Tim on this topic. I have not been able to read what he said, so I will be a sort of chair respondent. If I can't think of anything immediately to say, I will put it over to you and then come in later. But hopefully I'll have some response. Tim.
Thank you very much.
I'll set an example.
The cheese has been broken.
Yeah.
And thank you very much, Megan, for jumping in. But also that particular collection, that edited collection, is very much in the back of my mind for a lot of this talk today. Part of what I've been thinking about, and actually I think the earliest times when I had thoughts about space and transnational cinema, was this article by Megan, particularly thinking about the difference between the any space whatsoever and particular sorts of spaces like warehouses or seemingly disposable spaces or proletarian spaces, and how those sit alongside the spaces that you get in a James Bond film or some of the films that I'll talk about today. So how is it that the sites in which action and violence play out and within cinema might tell us something about class but also tell us something about mobility? And that work continues to be really useful to me, and I think that'll come across. I hope it comes across clearly. So this paper, it is mainly about high-budget action films in the North American context, sometimes called blockbusters, but mainly in the main interest is international co-productions. My focus is not primarily on the logics of the commercial funding arrangements, but I have to say the backdrop to the paper is an acceleration of film co-productions between mainland Chinese and Indian producers, Indian and US producers, and between US investors, and quite specifically the China Film Group, so it's a series of films that have been made with similar arrangements. By virtue of their conditions of emergence as transnational capital ventures, many of these co-production films appear somewhat opportunistic in their casting and their themes, and I can talk a bit about that as we go along. But I do want to sketch out some sort of consistent implications for cultural identity and gender identity that emerge from a particular type of transnational film. So I'm particularly interested in those that actively recruit action stars from multiple countries and kind of throw them together and often put a story, organise a storyline around a set of attractions. As these films attempt to stage meaningful cross-cultural relationships in a transnational space, I think they're actually really useful for thinking about the work masculinity does to shape geographical and geopolitical imaginaries. One such film is Zhang Yimou's The Great Wall, a US-China film group co-production. films, just as a bit of context for the production of this particular film, over the last 10 years, films with a certain proportion of Chinese funding receive tax exemptions within mainland China. So it's actually made a lot of sense for a certain type of co-production to emerge between the China Film Group and then other Hollywood film producers, right? So there's a particular logic to the way in which a film gets to be seen as a national film or an international film. The Great Wall seemed to push on existing logics of blockbuster branding and screenwriting to some limits of tendencies that already existed. So in this particular context, Matt Damon becomes a hero to lead a Chinese army against flesh-eating monsters attacking the Great Wall of China. In fact, even reading that out, I sort of find it amazing that this plot exists and that this film has been made. But it has, and so we work with the results. I actually want to show you a short scene from this film, partly because of the narrative of... partly because of what we see in terms of the action of the scene, but also to give you a sense of what kind of movie this is and where masculinity might enter in. I'm going to make sure that the subtitles... It looks like the subtitles will be... There's a few things I want to point out just in terms of the plot of this film. Firstly, there's these engagements and interactions we see right at the beginning that seem to be about trust and about kind of establishing how it is that different fighting techniques or different skills might kind of produce sympathies or affinities between the character played by Pedro Pascal and the character played by Matt Damon, and then the various characters who are guarding the Great Wall of China. That plot line really quickly disappears when some CGI monsters arrive from the north. Not that I have anything particularly against CGI, but it does actually really shift the tone of the movie. And so there's a sense in which there's a little movie that happens for about 20 minutes that's about trust and diplomacy and etiquette, and that little movie falls away. Part of the film didn't get particularly good reviews in North America, also didn't get particularly good reviews in mainland China. It was a successful enough film to make back its money. Some of the backlash to the film in North America, as some of you might know, was about the racial and cultural politics of Matt Damon being cast in this sort of implausible heroic position within the film, which I think is a really legitimate critique. But there were also some other criticisms from people, particularly within mainland China, who are familiar with Wuxia films and particularly familiar with Zhang Yimou's films. And one of the really early criticisms was to say, well, like part of it seems to have the visual aesthetic of a Wuxia film and a Zhang Yimou film in terms of the scale of the extras and the use of colour and the sense of a sublime organisation of fighters and the use of space. But that actually a scene like this is quite uncharacteristic of the genre in the sense that the fighting skills become something that people show off and brand almost in a... for want of a better phrase, like a pissing contest, or one that's very much about testing masculinity rather than letting Matt Damon's prowess or the prowess of the fighters emerge through certain sorts of practices or confrontations, right? So in previous films like, say, Hero by Zhang Yimou, people's skills only become apparent when they're absolutely tested and they're forced to fight in a certain way, and that becomes part of the dignity of the fighter, that they don't go around sort of showing off for no reason whatsoever, unless they are a bad character, right? So some of the response to the film was also about saying, well, the values, why is it that Matt Damon is so heroic, that he's coming here to, in part, to show off? But I'll come back to that later because I'll give you some other examples of a different sort of film. So the storyline clearly serves a set of casting priorities in terms of the attractions of the feature. In addition to his US celebrity with the Bourne Identity franchise, which wasn't very popular in mainland China, Matt Damon was actually very successful globally, including with Chinese audiences, with The Martian in 2015. So that's a little bit of context for him as well. His co-star Pedro Pascal is Chilean-born and regularly cast to play South American characters alongside North American characters. So even though he's Chilean-American, he sort of becomes the stand-in for any number of different characters from Latin America. The Great Wall also features supporting actor Andy Lau, a Hong Kong star and cantopop singer who's sort of moving sideways for a variety of reasons into mainland Chinese cinema and abruptly arriving at a battle scene as Lu Han. And he's a former member of K-pop group EXO, which had its own Mandarin-speaking branch called EXO-M. And I'll come back a little bit to these other sorts of men that we see in the frame. The only key actor emerging from the mainland Chinese film industry is actually Jin Tian. She also starred in Police Story 2013, the first version of the Police Story franchise to be transplanted from Hong Kong to mainland China. So I'm not just kind of giving this all to you to overwhelm you with the number of different people who are in different films and the things that they've done. And I don't think this mixture of actors from different industries is particularly new. And I don't think the transnational film will kind of lead to a utopian kaleidoscope of cultures. More interesting, I think, is the way that certain kinds of storylines are being borrowed, adapted or transformed to accommodate the transnational dynamics of this sort of blockbuster arrangement. In particular, I think masculinity provides an important thread that links a film like The Great Wall to other blockbusters with North American stars, but that might have cast members from outside of North America, like the Fast and the Furious franchise, XXX, the Return of Xander Cage, The Expendables, and also the Mission Impossible franchise. Before pushing on this argument, though, I do want to clarify that transnational arrangements do not necessarily produce a distinct transnational aesthetic sensibility or cultural syncretism in any mechanical way. Sometimes films about travel, and even equipped with stars from different markets and location shoots, can travel exceptionally badly, even if they do try and do this work around masculinity. So just as a point of comparison, I wanted to mention Chadney Chowk to China, which in a way might have some superficial resemblances to The Great Wall. In this Indian-US co-production, it drew on the familiar humour of Akshay Kumar, thrown together with superstar Deepika Padukone and well-known Chinese martial artist veteran Gordon Liu. And there were sort of Bollywood dance sequences. There's a plot tribute to Stephen Chow that sort of happens along the way. So a chef from the Chadni Chowk markets in India draws on his cooking skills to defeat a diamond smuggler oppressing a small Chinese town that actually also happens to be near the Great Wall. And so we have another sort of saviour narrative of someone else coming into mainland China, but with some different inflections. This film did really terribly at the Indian box office. It did really terribly at the Chinese box office, even though it seemed to be tailored to these multiple markets. And far more successful was a film like Dangal. Some of you might know Dangal, an Amir Khan and Disney co-production about two sisters who become world wrestling champions for India. And this was very much framed around sentimental attachments to local spaces and humble family life in India. It became the highest grossing Indian film of all time internationally, and certainly the highest grossing Indian film in China. The reason I've mentioned this is just to emphasise that these international co-productions do not necessarily demand international narratives. They often profit from resonances between a structure of nationalist identification and sort of affiliated structures of belonging. So nationalisms don't always seek to exclude each other, especially when we consider nationalism as a sort of a genre of expression with attached aesthetic conventions. So in the case of Kung Fu Yoga, which I'll also turn to later, we might even say that nationalism can become like a hall of mirrors, reflecting onto and through each other through common commitments to, say, some sort of cultural integrity or the embodied solidity of national personhood. So I'm really just indicating that the transnational film can precisely be the one that is ultra-nationalist in certain respects, or that it's about the structure of the film, not necessarily about the representation of the transnational space. Okay, so we might want a more precise set of tools to talk about the differences between transnational films, which is one of my aims today. In On the Plurality of Cinematic Transnationalism, Meta Hjort provides a useful corrective to sort of overzealous uses of the term transnational to describe cinema, and I've probably been overzealous already, noting the differences between unmarked transnationalism, which may include any number of financing arrangements, location shoots, maybe international casting practices, and marked transnationalism, which involves drawing the attention of viewers towards various transnational properties that encourage thinking about transnationality in itself. Within this frame, she distinguishes between several modalities, and I'm sort of interested in three types of transnationalism here. The first is a sort of epiphanic transnationalism, which describe films that explore deep historical and cultural links between nations. In the organisation of a narrative that's sort of against a mythic historical backdrop, this would describe something like Kung Fu Yoga, and also a film called The Myth. So both Kung Fu Yoga and The Myth are collaborations between Stanley Tong as director, who also directed Rumble in the Bronx, and Jackie Chan. And in both of these cases, in the first 5 minutes of the film and then the very closing sort of frames of the film, we get a throwback to a longer historical context of communication between India and China. These films remind viewers that India and China have long been linked through trade and politics and profit from Chinese audiences some familiarity with the story of Xuanzang. I do apologize for my pronunciation here. I'm trying to work on it. Xuanzang, a 7th century Chinese Buddhist monk who journeyed to India. But the comedic genre of Stanley Tong films and Jackie Chan films actually give more space to explore a second modality of transnationalism, which Hjort describes as affinitive transnationalism, which plays more on the contingent overlaps between peoples or explore a common problem sort of experienced across national boundaries. So the myth and kung fu yoga are consistently concerned with the preservation of unique cultural heritage and with the corrosive impact of capital on culture, and then and as something that both affects India and as something that affects China. And then there's a sort of symbiosis of spiritual forms. So the exemplar here is Indian practices of yoga and Chinese practices of yoga. So in kung fu yoga, there's just like a neat little scene which kind of indicates that that there are equivalences to the way that yoga is being done in India and China, but there are also sort of crucial differences, and this becomes part of the competition between the two of the female characters in the film, which doesn't really sort of amount to anything because the film doesn't care enough about those two female characters. So, but it's something that's sort of that's put in there. Nevertheless, I don't think that these films seek to blur or fracture national cultural identities. One reason, perhaps, could be that that this might involve the recognition of ethnic minorities that, as far as I've observed, are often excluded from Chinese action cinema and also Bollywood action cinema. So the sense that there are several films that are about journeying between mainland China and between India, but not necessarily about all of the spaces along the way and the sort of cultural composition of those spaces. So they're both films about geography, but they're about often the relationship between metropoles rather than other sorts of rural geography or regional geographies. However, there's a third category of transnationalism that I actually think might be the most useful here from Hjort. She gives a complex account of modernizing transnationalism, which doesn't necessarily posit modernization as a sort of teleological project, but does adapt transnational narratives to reflect on rapid social changes or class transformations. So Mary Beltran's commentary on Romeo Must Die and The Fast and the Furious can sort of be read this way. So this is one of the many installments of the Fast and the Furious franchise, and some of you might also be familiar with Romeo Must Die with Jet Li from the late 1990s. And Beltran's sort of argument that is a little bit consistent with what Hjort is saying about modernizing transnationalism, that the rapid emergence of Hispanic and Asian American youth consumer bases within the United States comes to be expressed through stories about transnational emancipation, where an upward close mobility opens up a sort of lateral mobility across peoples and places. So this sense that modernization not as a normative thing, but just as a word that could be used for a certain transformation in class relations, where especially there's a middle class consumer base that is forming new identities around the consumption of film and other media. Similarly, a series of Jackie Chan's films with Stanley Tong, so the ones I've mentioned, Rumble in the Bronx, Kung Fu Yoga, also from a couple of years ago, CZ12, wrestle with the new conditions faced by a diasporic Chinese middle class, which is celebrated in some films, say in the context of small businesses, in Rumble in the Bronx, so the object of protection for that film is a Chinese small business, but it becomes corrosive when it's about pursuing speculative capital or sort of trampling over and forgetting about cultural heritage. So Kung Fu Yoga is modernizing, not in the sense that it's trying to show that China is modern in some way, but in its treatment of transnationalism as a sort of dangerous new horizon opened up by capital, technology, and a sort of class of people who are slightly suspicious of being culturally rootless. In this context, my interest is then in the way that transnationalism comes to be imagined and dramatized through these sort of spatial stories. So acts of, when we think about where masculinity might fit in here, we might say that acts of dominance, aggression, and combat sort of presuppose a milieu, a preparation of borders and materials that hold together individuals in this place or that. In the context of action cinema, we might also think about fictions around what is an inclusive space or an exclusive space that frame the emergence of certain sort of masculinities as being viable as they cross borders. Okay. So here I want to take, and I'm sorry, I'm taking a few little detours. It is a little bit like an action cinema romp where you go to like a few other sort of places along the way and you sort of end up at, eventually you end up at the place that you started. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Doreen Massey's engagement with concepts of space because of the way in which they resonate with some of the problems that are thrown up by some of these films. So in her commentary on Ernesto Laclau, Massey notes that within a particular critical tradition, space is kind of understood to be a static backdrop within which temporal action takes place. And in the worst instance, as a mystification or reification of what is at the expense of what could become, where becoming is aligned with revolutionary and disruptive forces, right? So too much concern with space, we get too concerned in the here and now and not thinking about deep histories or possible radically different futures. So there's a whole modality of political thinking, which we might also think of as a genre of thinking within a film context, that asks what will happen next, whose actions are most oriented towards the future, rather than asking where are we now? What is the relationship between our presumed somewhere and the various other less familiar elsewheres? So if such and such a thing takes place, we might ask, how will this reconfigure the relationship between the here and the there? And this is sort of what Doreen Massey tries to push on, to say actually these spatial stories are stories about events can still take place, but it isn't about where they sit in the chronology any more than it is about where they sit in a kind of spatial configuration. So her argument is not just trying to say that we need more precise geographical description, but also for this account of events being understood according to all the different causal chains that might contribute to their possibility, and also all of the redistribution of places for which these events might have consequence. And that's kind of how I want to think about some of these transnational films. How are they distributing the places that are consequential or inconsequential, the places that produce causes, the places that are just the objects of causes. So this is one way of reading in a longer history James Bond films, but also the recent Mission Impossibles, The Fast and the Furious, and XXX, The Return of Xander Cage. The catalyst for action is not necessarily just an injustice or a conflict between persons who occupy the same space, but rather a weapon, a technology, or in James Bond, it might be like the device, that throws into disarray a national frame of action. So in XXX, Return of Xander Cage, the main protagonist, Xander Cage, who is known from two previous installments of the franchise, is torn away from his leisurely lifestyle in the Dominican Republic. He's sent by Americans to the UK, then to the Philippines. There's a conflict that ensues with Russian soldiers, who are themselves sort of played for laughs with these sort of Cold War and post-Cold War jokes. Another Vin Diesel vehicle, and I've already sort of shown you the poster for that for a while, passes by Azerbaijan and then through the United Arab Emirates. These films make explicit what is implicit in a way in most action narrative, that the past never maps neatly onto the future because the map of the future has a different cartography to the maps of the past. Nevertheless, as I'm sure you would have noticed, here the spatial diffusion in a lot of these films, and this is very much the case of James Bond as well, is transformed into a narrative problem that is still resolved in and through the nation state. So the major conflicts in these films are not seen to be particularly troubling to people in the Philippines or Azerbaijan or Abu Dhabi, right? It's like it's not, the films never seek to demonstrate that these are actually problems in those places that local people are experiencing as problems. Rather, the cinematic tourism sort of conforms to what AJ Galawat, in the context of Bollywood, describes as a claim to infinite spatial mobility in order to protect the borders of the nation state. So Galawat points out that the new Bollywood metrosexual, and so looking at rom-coms, looking at action films, but looking at many, many different types of masculinity in Bollywood, this metrosexual travels not to leave a cultural context or because they're a wanderer who's outside of culture, but to consolidate the provenance and legitimacy of a certain sort of cultural identity against the contaminations that might proliferate in international spaces. And you could also read some Jackie Chan films, not all of them, but certainly Rumble in the Bronx might have that aspect as well, that they are stories maybe about diaspora, but they're also about governing the cultural practices within a diaspora outside of one nation state. So the national borders in film are not necessarily simply geographical borders. So there can be borders. And certainly we get this in these films that are concerned with securitization. There are borders between America and non-America or even anti-America that are kind of replaced onto the Philippines or onto the Gulf states. It could even be a way of reading the Great Wall of China, right, in the film The Great Wall, to say, well, actually what this film is just trying to do is redeploy an anxiety about border protection and maintaining borders between peoples and between places, and then just projecting this onto another place. I don't think that's the only possible reading. I think that Zhang Yimou's own history of producing a more kind of nationalist cinema is really important there. But just as a general tendency, we could say that there are films where the protection of nation states doesn't necessarily require being at the place where one nation borders against another. It can be other sorts of struggles over space. Okay. So we can think about Marx transnationalism as involving different embodiments and invocations of nationhood along class and gender and ethnic lines as some of these borders, right? So the borders between nations might not be the political borders, but between different types of gender or different performances of gender, different expressions of ethnicity or different class identities. In Hollywood action cinema, I guess the ones that I'm the most concerned about today have been the ensemble films dominated by globally unimpeded men. And these men are often sort of placed side by side as competing versions of hegemonic masculinity. I'm not sure if I necessarily need to give a refresher on the concept of hegemonic masculinity because it circulates really widely. One of the things that I'll say about it is that it's about this notion that in order for masculinity to be hegemonic or come to dominate a certain space, the archetype of that masculinity does not necessarily need to exist or even be plausible within a space. So it doesn't necessarily require that there are ideal masculinities that other people imitate, but rather that there's an arrangement or competition, and the focus has mostly been on competition between men to kind of position themselves in relation to a norm. So understood from this viewpoint, the heroic and often pristine forms of masculinity in action cinema could be read as a sort of epiphenomena of more complex social struggles among real men and around real women. Those are odd phrases that I don't really like using, but contests in different social contexts over the meanings of gender, wherein no one particularly thinks that they can live up to the ideals that are presented on screen. This could also predispose us to think of naturalistic cinema as being best suited to actually showing the fallibility and real features of bodies, and to think of action cinema as sort of just presenting unattainable ideals or ideals that set people up for failure. And this is actually where S.V. Srinivas's work, Kara Keeling's work, and also Megan Morris's work has been really useful for me to think, well, you know, if we've got these films that rely on certain sorts of strong gender stereotypes, what is it that can be done with those stereotypes other than saying that, you know, young boys might look up to them, think that they can become them, and then feel this failure of disappointment? You know, is there another story that can be told about these stereotypes? And in Stereotypes of Solidarity, Srinivas notes that within some, that larger-than-life personae can become important vehicles for collective memory, cross-cultural recognition, and the emergence of local and vernacular cultures. So Srinivas notes that, say, within some northeastern states of India, active political resistance to Bollywood film, so a kind of resistance particularly to the dominance of Hindi language dramas and action films and comedies, has created space for the significant consumption of Korean and Hong Kong popular culture. Srinivas also notes that there are many stereotypes in Hong Kong cinema, and I'll come to these a little bit later, about Chineseness and about Chinese masculinity. It's full of stereotypes around different types of masculinity, but also stereotypes about India. There's like many, the films that are made particularly in Hong Kong that are about India often draw on the most familiar impressions of India that might be borrowed from other films or from tourist brochures or from a tourist impression of certain sort of well-visited sites. But this all plays into a film viewing culture, in part dependent on pirated DVDs, within which, and I'm sort of quoting Srinivas here, virtually everything we see in the film is framed by an earlier representation. For Srinivas, the implausibility of stereotypes sort of means that they cease to matter because of their sheer banality. Given that action cinema is a highly mobile genre and could not in fact be imagined without these long histories of cross-cultural influence and collaboration, it makes sense that certain stereotypes about masculinity might be over-exaggerated in order to signal a shared recognition with audiences about the history of the genre formation and the history of its provenance within a particular cultural locality. So within this context, the accusation that a certain masculinity is hegemonic or that it's sort of deceiving people about how viable it is or how good it is might be a slightly simplistic understanding of media usage as something that forms community, that forms memory. Where I do think the concept of hegemonic masculinity is useful is for understanding some of the dynamics within these ensemble cast films. So as Raewyn Connell has noted in reviews of the concept, it may be that most of the gendered practices that support hegemonic masculinity actually involve complicity within a norm rather than efforts to realise that norm. This provides us with a useful starting point to think about the character, Zhao Guang in Kung Fu Yoga, played by K-pop star Zhang Yixing. And Jackie Chan over there. And also the character of Nick Zhao in XXX, The Return of Xander Cage, who's played by Chris Wu. Both of them are K-pop stars from the same group, XOM, and as I've already mentioned, it's a Chinese counterpart to XOK, and so basically there's a Korean version of the group, there's a Chinese version of the group, they do exactly the same video clips, they release exactly the same songs. In the video clips, like, they're all positioned in the same way, but there might be like a slight shift, like one of them will be wearing a red shirt in the Chinese one and a green shirt in the Korean one. But it's actually like a really interesting and highly successful transnational marketing strategy for a K-pop group. In any case, the third example here is also another group of EXO. So I didn't start off in this project thinking I'd like talk about three different films that have three different guys from the same K-pop group. But this is kind of a sign of the times about the success of this franchise. And this third example with Lu Han, he plays a minor character in The Great Wall and is a sort of romance and rom-com star in mainland China. He's very successful. So Chris Wu, Zhang Yixing and Lu Han exemplify what Sun Jung calls a soft pan-Asian masculinity, one that is shaped by youth consumer cultures, cosmetics consumption and sponsorship, and more fraternal camaraderies with women, rather than, say, sort of a paternalistic assertion of gender, social gender roles. Well, that's what these media representations are suggesting. An unexpected result, though, of these pop stars crossing over into this blockbuster cinema is that rather than one masculinity kind of succeeding another one in a wholesale shift, a generational shift, a number of films are reworking these softer masculinities as sort of apprenticeships to more rigid patriarchs, right? So rather, if you just look at it in terms of K-pop, you're like, oh, look, there's all of these videos. They seem to be really, really different from this notion of aggressive men or men who are sort of attached to certain types of social hierarchy. These don't seem to be hierarchical video clips. But when understood in the broader media context of how these stars are coming to circulate, actually these storylines are quite important because these become the narrative face in terms of how these men positioned in relation to other sorts of masculinities that are already very well established. So as Cam Louie and Sun Jung both noted and in their respective accounts of contemporary Chinese masculinities and Korean masculinities, accounts of new masculine ideals need to remain attentive to the media circuits within which these masculinities acquire currency. So we could use the framework of hegemonic masculinity to say that within films like XXX, The Great Wall and Kung Fu Yoga, sort of represented here through the faces of members of XOM, the regional popularity of K-pop and soft masculinities is subject to some degree of capture, which is not to say that K-pop is by any means perfect, but to suggest, and maybe that's something I can talk about a little bit more in question time, the relationship between these media cultures. Okay, so in terms of the men alongside which these three guys fight or support, we could describe them as films that are about groups of men dominating different kinds of spaces through finely differentiated mobilities. In XXX, the female characters are often quite literally immobile compared with the male characters, so the camera slows down or halts entirely to film Deepika Padukone, and she only ever arrives in spaces sort of already claimed and instrumentalised by the male leads. But that might be slightly too simplistic, because even less screen time is granted to Tony Jaa, who plays a trickster character that kind of lends a cosmopolitanism to XXX. As the celebrated star of the Ong Bak franchise, a poster for Ong Bak that I can highly recommend. His Thai identity suggests the possibility of many elsewheres that Vin Diesel and Donnie Yen, the two main male protagonists, might travel. But the film itself has little interest in where Tony Jaa comes from or where he'll go at the end of the film. This may be because, in part, it didn't seem to matter much financially whether the film itself travelled to Thailand, at least not compared with many of the other places that the film was intended to be consumed. Right, so we get I wouldn't want to stress too much the homology between imagined consumer demographics or consumer bases and the plot line of a film. But in particular moments, you think, well, actually, they could have spent an extra 20 minutes with Tony Jaa, and it kind of sends some kind of signal about who is assumed to know Donnie Yen, who is assumed to know Vin Diesel, Deepika Padukone, and then where would Tony Jaa sit in there? We could also comment that Donnie Yen himself has undergone a significant transformation, and even given the diversity of roles that he's had in Hong Kong action cinema. So some of you might be familiar with many of the roles he's played in Hong Kong, know that Megan had a paper that I saw in Seoul that was specifically about Donnie Yen in the Ip Man franchise. It's not as though he always plays a completely wonderful or lovely guy, so, you know, we wouldn't want to overstate the notion that he's a Cantonese nationalist in Hong Kong cinema and becomes this completely different sort of character in XXX, because he has played a diversity of roles. But the ethics of the sort of character that he is significantly different here to any of the characters that he's played in the past, I would say. I'm discussing John Woo's A Better Tomorrow films. Aaron Han Jun Magnang Park tracks what he describes as a sort of shift from the Confucian ethos of Ren, so involving a creation of social harmony through the proper enactment of moral etiquette and sort of resulting in a brotherhood of heroes, to the American ethos of heroic individualism, which forfeits symmetry between brothers in favour of a sort of triumphant protagonist. And I think this dynamic can be detected in the casting of Donnie Yen from his Hong Kong action roles to his XXX persona, in the sense that even though a lot of his films are about his masculinity and about his relationship to other men, and that hasn't necessarily shifted that much in XXX, often what happens in his Hong Kong films is this practice that is being associated here with John Woo, which is this constant mirroring with other sorts of men who have similar or comparable skills, and they might be from a different martial arts school, or they might be older, so there might be a generational transition. But that in the North American version of these sorts of narratives, it absolutely just becomes about one man being superior to the other men, and in demonstrations of strength or agility. So I can talk about that more in question time also. It's also interesting to note that the other places that we'd be likely to see the diverse ensemble casting, this type of ensemble casting in action films, because historically we actually might be far more likely to see it in terms of gang members or bullies or henchmen. And here I think Rumble in the Bronx is actually a really good touchstone, right? So you might just have in a mess of different characters who sort of have unspecified backgrounds, there might be someone who we assume is a Hispanic character, and they'll say to someone else, you know, hey amigo, or there'll just be some small sort of indicator. So there is a prehistory of these sorts of films and these sorts of combinations, say of an Asian American character and a Hispanic American character and a white American character. But often that will be in the case of gangs or some signal of polluted inner city spaces. So I'm also sort of just giving you that as a point of contrast, because the films, particularly XXX and the Fast and the Furious franchise, seem to be about a very different class of men. They seem to be about middle class or upper class men who are highly mobile, who are working in a gig economy. They end up in Dubai, they end up in Abu Dhabi or different sort of metropolitan centres. So I actually say that there's the transnational blockbusters, rather than being about cramped and finite urban spaces that are sort of like a clustering together of different working class groups who might have some shared class identity but very different cultural backgrounds, and in the case of Rumble in the Bronx, no class consciousness. Diversity is a sign of unbounded, infinite cosmopolitan masculinities. So infinite mobility rather than lack of mobility holds together the sort of spaces that we see in something like XXX. Okay. Give me a second here. So the thing that I want to use to draw these things together is that the way in which spaces are occupied by strangers, especially when some conception of dominant masculinity is at stake. The issue is not simply whether a film endorses or condemns different types of masculinity. I think it matters how differences are identified or taken up within a particular type of encounter. So to develop this theme, I want to think about the prehistory that's offered a little bit by the Wuxia films of King Hu, and then the films of Jackie Chan. So the King Hu films, Come Drink With Me from 1966, Dragon Inn 1967 and A Touch of Zen in 1971, each contain long and tense sequences organised around spaces of suspicion directed towards strangers. Characters arrive in unfriendly spaces or unfriendly strangers arrive in a familiar space and a subtle game of recognition and signification begins. The key scenes that take place in inns are quite well known from Come Drink With Me and also A Touch of Zen. And if this little clip, I'll show you a very, very short little clip, partly as a contrast to the atmosphere of the Great Wall and also something that we'll watch afterwards. Oh. So the reason why I've shown you that little clip and mentioned these films is that there is this longer history within Hong Kong cinema that isn't necessarily about transnational movements, although these particular films, Dragon Gate Inn, is made in Taiwan, so there's a dimension of transnationality here. It isn't necessarily about people explicitly coming from different nation states, but it's about people coming from other places and people being in spaces that are maybe very local spaces, very humble spaces, but that are populated by strangers and about negotiating that population of a space by strangers. And so I want to sort of indicate that something like The Great Wall, even though there's all sorts of things that are very different about it and there's all sorts of films that happen in between, but to think that actually the encounter between people who absolutely don't know each other or come from radically different contexts is not unfamiliar to this genre. In fact, there's this particular cycle where it's precisely about how people behave in those spaces or how people come to establish who are their friends and who are their enemies in these spaces. So one has to come to understand who one is for others in these spaces. And I think gender actually becomes a really crucial dynamic in this self-surveillance. So King Hu dramatises, in addition to the scene that we've seen here, in Come Drink With Me, the female knight errant is the most precariously positioned in these games of identity and misidentification. These games are games where hegemonic masculinity actually doesn't quite make sense, if by this we sort of mean a consensus about the masculinity that holds value. There are still hierarchies between people, but a world of travelling strangers demands an openness to hierarchies functioning along entirely unexpected axes. So it's not as though King Hu sort of has these utopias of people just kind of hanging out together who haven't met before and they have a good time and trade different skills, right? They've actually all got deep interests that are about class interests or about political interests or historical interests. But King Hu does bring forth an intensified curiosity, crafting spaces that intensify social possibilities embedded in seemingly ordinary and quotidian spaces. This gives rise to an ethics attuned to the connections between ways of inhabiting the local without positioning the characters or indeed the camera itself at a point of surveillance above the local. So more recently, Stephen Chow's and I kind of gave this away because you saw a frame from Shaolin Soccer. Stephen Chow's and Wong Jin's comedies, that I think broadly sort of characterised as Mo Lei Tao, extract humour from the King Hu scenario. So often they take the King Hu scenario and sort of make it a funny scenario. So the most fallible and weak-looking characters often have these unbelievably awesome martial arts skills, and that would be like the running gag. So someone who serves you noodles in a noodle shop and seems to be very, very slow at doing this is actually extremely good at martial arts, and that actually becomes part of the logic of how you respond to that space. You act as if that is always a possibility. So the signs of power that people wear on their bodies can always be fallible, and the codes can be switched in a sort of subterranean field of talents and powers might be revealed. This also allows us to think about what's happening in that Great Wall clip with which we begun, right? And maybe some of the negative responses to that as a genre film, right? What does it mean in that type of script to Matt Damon to have already conferred his own self-worth in this space, right? To have a space where people kind of instantly are making judgments about how good each other are, and then there's some sort of competition between men. And then thinking, well, actually there's quite a different logic that's been set up and embedded both in the humorous and non-humorous versions of wuxia as a genre. Okay, I can come back to that again. So let's consider finally what Jackie Chan does with his spaces of strangers as he moves in order to arrive at Kung Fu Yoga. The archetypical Jackie Chan fight sequence is often about existing in and through spaces one inhabits, where every table or bench or kitchen appliance can sort of become a resource for combat. And part of his humour, but also I think his appeal, is his plasticity in relation to new environments. He approaches a shared space with strangers with humility and curiosity. Correspondingly, the lack of curiosity about surrounding objects and surfaces is what disempowers other male characters who believe that strength alone grants them dominion over space, right? So it isn't like, you know, Jackie Chan isn't doing arm wrestles with people. That's basic. part of, and part of his skills might be that he's better at martial arts, but often it's also about the sense in which his skills actually have a relationship to the space he's in. That's what it means for him in many contexts to be better at martial arts. So let's take an example of a clash of different types of masculinity in relation to space from Kung Fu Yoga. As mentioned before, this sort of revives a theme that's in The Myth from 2005, which is also a Stanley Tong film. In both films, there's a deep historical link between China and India, as I've already indicated, and this goes way back to the sort of armor of God storyline in the 1980s, where Jackie Chan is an archaeologist. In Kung Fu Yoga, he leads a team of Chinese and Indian explorers to help retrieve the lost Magadha treasures, buried somewhere in Tibet. The antagonist, or on the Tibetan plateau. The antagonist is well-known Bollywood and Tollywood villain Sonu Sood, who's sort of probably best known for the Hindi language remake of Dabang. He's in many fantastic films. But he now plays a character called Randall in Kung Fu Yoga. And this is our first introduction to Randall. Jackie Chan is there, is with his team of explorers. They're buried in ice. They've just kind of discovered some treasures. And now they're having to confront Randall, who also wants the treasures.
Yes, boss.
Does anyone believe that Jackie Chan is going to freeze to death? So after this sequence, it's an extended fight. It delivers on many trademark tricks from Jackie Chan. He's very adaptable to using the resources in an ice cavern. And so my question is sort of what's happening in this transnational space. It follows a pattern from many of Jackie Chan's encounters in his films about travel. The dividers between cultural spaces that need to be preserved and disposable spaces that must be destroyed in order to be preserved, right? So, I mean, a lot of his action involves completely decimating certain types of spaces. And in these collaborations with Stanley Tong in The Myth and Kung Fu Yoga, the drama of good versus evil is often between the sordid spaces of commerce, so that'll be also some of the spaces that Randall will occupy, where the reckless circulation of commodity objects risks undermining the particular objects and particular spaces linked to national cultures. So the villains correspondingly are not completely members of one cultural group, one particular group or another. I don't think that Jackie Chan makes a strongly xenophobic film as such. I think that would be a not a complex enough reading of what he does. It's rather that his villains forget their membership within a cultural group. This is already the case in Rumble in the Bronx, which I think I've got a little... Oh, I don't have the still here. Which features a Cantonese-speaking gang member in New York, and he's kind of like forgotten his origins and he gets beaten up. And this comes across clearly with Randall in Kung Fu Yoga. His villainy is not actually linked to his Indianness, or I think that's the conceit of the film, right? The conceit of the film where the baddies are Indians, but it's trying to be this co-production that's trying to be diplomatic in some way. But it's actually that he keeps on forgetting his Indianness. And I'd say that Jackie Chan is like a serial mansplainer in this film in particular. Like he just keeps on telling Randall about Indian histories and Randall doesn't know about the Indian histories. He doesn't know anything about the place that he's grown up or any of his own family history. So that's kind of the family dynamic. That's that's the way that it's worked through. And this is actually how conflict is resolved in this film. So just as Randall is about to escape at the very end, I guess this is a spoiler, Randall does not win overall in Kung Fu Yoga, members of the local Indian community arrive to pay their respects to the treasures and to the temple that's been undiscovered deep underground. And so we sort of think that we're moving through a Raiders of the Lost Ark or an Indiana Jones-style narrative. It's actually got many references to Indiana Jones and sort of spoofs of Indiana Jones. There's a temple that's discovered and all of this gold. But instead of it being about Jackie Chan being superior in terms of his moral qualities to Randall, although that's already mapped throughout the film, the way in which Jackie Chan actually wins is that Randall is reminded of his Indian identity, is that because people of different faiths come there to pray, because they kind of follow Jackie Chan and Randall into this space. It's like Randall can't possibly bear to escalate the conflict and steal the treasure, right? So he isn't actually defeated by martial arts. He isn't defeated by a show of strength. He's defeated by these values of cultural belonging. And so we could easily think of this space as a border space that exists outside of outside the Indian nation space and outside of the Chinese nation space, because we don't exactly know where we are, but it's about the borders between who knows their cultural identity and who doesn't, who's forgotten it because they're too invested in commerce. I will also mention, just to put this in perspective as well, and you probably don't, it might just be interesting for you to know that this exists, that is a common pattern in Jackie Chan films for the bad global capitalists to be between cultures or traitors to their own cultures. And this also happens in a movie that's come out much more recently. So this was sort of coming out as I was thinking about this paper, which is Buddies in India. And Wang Bao-ching has actually made several comedies of this sort, so some of you might know about Holiday in Thailand. Both Holiday in Thailand and Buddies in India are very, very successful films from mainland China. But again, the key villain is a guy who doesn't seem to know his own cultural identity. I think this is actually, in many ways, a much more racist film, in a sort of old-fashioned, unexpectedly old-fashioned way, where part of the villainy of the Chinese entrepreneur is that he has this taste for women who are not Chinese, right? So he's sort of in swimming pools having these sort of erotic liaisons with women who are not Chinese, and this becomes part of his problem. But I guess I'm mentioning this just to suggest that actually there's some sort of commonality between a character like Randall, who doesn't know anything about his cultural history, and the Chinese entrepreneur in Buddies in India. Because it isn't just that these films are pro or anti-India in some way, even though a lot of the film takes place in India, but much more about policing people's sense of cultural identity and cultural belonging. I want to finish then on a slightly different note. In talking about different relationships to spaces, I guess my aim has been to arrive at the notion of vulnerability that's attuned to the variety of stories that get told about masculinity. My original intention was to talk heaps about vulnerability, and I sort of didn't. And I found it a really difficult concept to work with. And I think this is because so much transnational action cinema, but so much action cinema in general, is about going to new places, experiencing and overcoming vulnerability. And so the term vulnerability easily gets conflated with weakness, and then that has to be sort of overcome at all costs. So rather than resting on vulnerability itself, I wanted to think about, I guess, the modalities of inhabiting vulnerability, kind of taking that term apart a little bit. What appealed to me in King Hu, and I guess what I've maybe found missing in some transnational action blockbusters, and especially the North American ones I'm talking about, are situated vulnerabilities that describe vulnerabilities that lead to curiosity, rather than the particular places one is in needing to be overcome, right? So rather than seeing one's place-based finitude as just a site of weakness, so that one has to get in a car or a plane and leave, but that actually leads to some curiosity about what can be done in that space. The recent blockbuster films I've discussed, such as The Great Wall and XXX, use conflicts in transnational space as a kind of motive for fortifying oneself against the world. The heroes must simply be able to withstand whatever strangeness or foreignness they encounter. It's just like, how much can they handle, and can they handle it for 120 minutes? And I would sort of call this like a transcendent response to vulnerability, one that's about overcoming one's situatedness. So to come full circle, maybe this is also what blockbuster films try to do commercially, right? They seek to transcend their own situatedness in a particular cultural history and geographical milieu. This presentation has tried to sketch out at least sort of a set of reference points or approaches for thinking about this alignment between the blockbuster as a form and the transnational narrative as a way of dominating space. Thank you very much for listening.
Obviously, it's really difficult to respond to such a rich and dense paper. I love this talk. But I'll throw out a couple of issues. I've always kind of cringed a bit at the concept of hegemonic masculinity. I really like what you did with it, because to me, you have to always ask, hegemonic for whom? Hegemony, it doesn't make any sense unless you situate the space within which a particular cultural ideal or a force is hegemonic. And all too often, I mean, particularly in mainstream feminist discussion, hegemonic masculinity or whiteness or cisgender thing is invoked, and then if somebody from a,
a non-American dominant cultural space says, oh, but it's not like that, then you're accused of being in denial, right? So in other words, what's hegemonic there is the rhetoric of hegemony coming from a mainstream US academic posture, which is transnational because those books are sold everywhere and they're on all your reading lists, you know, so the Americanization of the mind is quite a significant thing. So what you did with the looking at the film so closely and with such a delicate touch was kind of open up that question. And it's a question that you always have to raise with transnational cinema, because if a film is in whatever manner genuinely transnational at the level of production, then there are competing hegemonic ideals simply at the level of the people making the film. They have different desires, different audiences in mind. I've studied that a few years ago with the great 1970s Australian film, The Man from Hong Kong, you know, and there are records about what the then young, brash Australian filmmakers thought they were doing, and they were actually dealing with these incredibly senior Hong Kong film industry figures. The Australians had made about 2 movies. Wong Yu had made 37, and the Australians thought they'd just have a bit of fun, you know. So you look at this, then there's always a plurality of agendas at work in the production, and then when the film starts to circulate, particularly if it's successful, then the uptake by the audience is something that you cannot account for with bell hooks in one hand and the latest feminist classic in the other. You know, you have to get out there and learn about a number of different discussions. That's biscuit. You should never eat biscuit before you go to talk. But by looking at the performers and their star baggage and the spaces in which they interact the way they did, you've shown us a way, I think about that without getting depressed, like, oh, my God, I don't have the money to go to 50 places and see how those audiences understood the film or to do ethnography. And I thought that was just fabulous, and I look forward to seeing the elaborated version of it. The question I'm going to ask you is more about, more at the industrial level, I suppose. I'm particularly interested at the moment in mainland Chinese experiments in soft power. I think they're starting to get really, really good at it after having been really bad. I see this still as someone who lived in Hong Kong for 12 years. I don't mean to be a downer, but one of our students at Lingnan today is almost certainly going to be jailed tomorrow for 13 months for having participated in a demonstration in 2014. A demonstration against corrupt dealings in the northeast New Territories of Hong Kong, which is currently occupied by small farmers and will soon be handed over to mega-scale developments for the rich of Shenzhen to come across the border. So there was a lot of violent demonstrations in 2014, and today 13 young people have been given 13-month jail sentences for participating in this, and they're mostly the leaders of the post-occupation thing. We're in an age where not many people can keep up with international news anyway, because traditional international news coverage has collapsed and you make your own kind of thing online. But I'm really staggered by the lack of interest in these developments in countries which should be looking to their own future, I think, and I would include Australia in that. So I'm fascinated to see that some of the really good movies that China is not only starting to make but produce I don't know how many people here are aware that Tencent Pictures, run by Pony Ma, who is now the richest man in China, produced Wonder Woman. If you're looking, you know, at the structure of industrial production, there's a way of arguing that this is a Chinese picture. But more to the point, one of the sweetest anti-US militaristic films I've seen lately, namely Kong Skull Island, is also got Tencent Pictures stamp on it. Tencent is a mainland company that is doing really, really well making movies off games, you know, and kind of really giving Marvel a run for their money. So Kong Skull Island, the white male hero is British. there's a Fay Wray figure, but, you know, Kong is the hero. It's kind of like Avatar meets Jurassic Park meets, you know, it's fantastic. I think so anyway. I mean, I love these things. And I'm also waiting to see Wolf Warrior 2, which, you know, is being commented on as a subject of great interest because it's apparently like really, really Hollywood and meets Hong Kong in terms of its presentation of heroism, but it's super, super patriotic and nationalistic. So far it's not doing well at the US box office because who wants to see in the US Bruce Willis taken over by a mainland Chinese hero? But the rest of the world, you know, we have bated breaths. I suspect I'm going to love it. You know, which is where the interesting questions sort of begin. So I want to focus on the in, you know, your choice of the in the second half, and sort of recall that in Hong Kong cinema, back in the 70s, yes, the in is where strangers gather, but then there's always a very marked category of the foreigner. You know, not all strangers are foreigners. Mm. And sometimes, as you said, they're ethnic minorities. Like if you look at Choi Hak, the representation of ethnic minorities in a film like The Blade is just scarifying, you know. Mm. But very, very very powerful, and it's in the inn where it all comes together, and the unspeakable plurality of ethnicities in China gets dramatized. But I'm wondering whether in the Great Wall, when Chinese critics object to it, whether they're not forgetting that the foreigner in 1970s Hong Kong film is always subject to challenge. That whole thing about, yeah, Shang Yimou, the true Xia is just going to hide his skills until called for. That is not true of 70s kung fu movies where the Japanese are like monkeys with their, you know, fists trailing on the ground. What really struck me as you were presenting The Great Wall was to see the American figure doing the American thing but getting away with it. And this is new within the Chinese soft power project. So I think we can't... I'd like to know how you see more the industrial strategy of doing that. I don't think it's just about selling it to the world, breaking in. China doesn't need to break in to a global market financially, but ideologically, absolutely. so how would you situate it in terms of a history of challenges to foreigners? And the sort of abject ancestor, really, is maybe the lost samurai, you know, from the Hollywood side. You remember Tom Cruise running around Japan, kind of, you know, fighting for the Meiji Emperor or fighting against him, I can't remember. But there, everybody laughed at Tom Cruise because, you know. But here it's a much more complicated thing. And the gaining of respect within that scene is actually done according to some quite traditional rules of how a foreigner or an outsider can gain face, you know. So that's a sort of set of comments around the direct question, which is really tell us about the K-pop people, right? And how do you see, because you know a lot about that, how do you see this deployment of these guys within the wider kinds of power projects that are washing around our region at the moment?
Yeah, I think that's a good that's where I would have gone in the question about the white Americans as well, is where the K-pop guys sit there. I mean, just to go back just slightly in the in your comments, I do think it's interesting reading both about mainland Chinese cinema at the moment, but also reading about Indian cinema, that it is often commonly observed, well, there's always the assumption, there's the assumption from people who come, who are used to talking about Hollywood, that there's always an imperative towards globalization and it always means the same thing. And of course, that's not necessarily at all, not only within mainland China, but also within India, that's not at all the main imperative. The main imperative might be about trying to work out, well, why do some people watch the same, go back to the cinema multiple times? How does this link to other sorts of franchising that are internal? It could be about remaking, finding more innovative ways to remake Tamil films and Telugu films. So in both of those contexts, it can be much more about the development of shopping malls or the development of new sorts of internal markets and trying to tap into existing practices of film reception, rather than just assuming that it's going to be a linear how many different countries was this screened in, which I think is maybe the assumption that's brought a little bit from Hollywood, that it's just about breaking markets. So maybe just as a first response, I've probably been a little bit too presumptuous that transnationalism is interesting in relation to these films in terms of transnational markets, rather than asking to what extent is that, what is the most interesting thing about something like the Great Wall or even Buddies in China, Buddies in India, sorry. It doesn't matter if Buddies in India is popular in India, or it doesn't really matter that much, and it might not matter so much with Kung Fu Yoga as well. So there is, so I guess that's just a first response, that I don't want to assume that the only geography that matters is it popular internally or externally, because internal geographies are complex in their own ways that are really important. In relation to the K-pop thing, I mean, I guess one of the things that people have been talking about a lot is because K-pop is popular, not just in South Korea, not just in mainland China, but also in Taiwan, in Japan, in the Philippines, in Thailand, and it's just, it seems like, in fact, every time I go to a new conference where people are discussing K-pop, there's a discovery of other places where K-pop is popular, and so even the cultural proximity arguments about K-pop, like, oh, there's maybe there are things about Korean popular culture that contain, say, Confucian values or a shared history that resonate with other nations. Even that argument is wearing a little bit thin, just because of its, or that argument doesn't explain K-pop in Iran or K-pop in all of these places where people didn't expect to find it being very popular. But one thing that people are saying, and I guess this is, we both know the work of Chow Ben-Huat. One of the things that I guess he's argued in that context is that it does provide, if a whole lot of people are watching K-pop, then it provides a K-pop videos, then it is a sort of a media literacy that sits there that filmmakers can capitalize on in different sorts of ways. They know that certain sorts of faces and performances will be at least a little bit familiar to people, that and that type of masculinity. And sometimes that's played for humour. So in the film 12 Golden Ducks, which is a Hong Kong mainland China co-production, but it's a comedy that's a long run. And I think the 12 Golden Ducks, my understanding of the translation, it's like maybe 12 Golden Chickens, but where there's a verbal pun on 12 golden sex workers, yeah. or That's the
chicken is a prostitute.
and that film will set up a guy from Hong Kong as having this sort of slapstick masculinity that where he's constantly failing. He's failing at being a sex worker. He's failing at getting out of sex work. All of these things, and then at a certain point in time, Lu Han comes in as the savior from right at the end of the film from South Korea, and the sign. Even though Lu Han is from mainland China, but his sort of credentials of being in a South Korean K-pop group. That will become a kind of a sign that you've made it. Like, you know that you've made it within 12 Golden Darks or 12 Golden Chickens if you're now hanging out with Lu Han as a kind of global, regionally mobile K-pop figure. So I think, but then what makes that difficult is not only that you're working across different formats, so just thinking, well, what are the temporalities of music videos versus the temporalities of films and thinking about how those things link. But I do think cosmetics industries can't be overlooked in terms of not just in terms of how those starts make money, but where those starts become familiar and how people recognize those faces that a lot of people will be recognizing Lu Han, they'll be recognizing Chris Wu. It might not necessarily be that they're watching Journey to the West 2, they might not be watching The Great Wall, but they might just be traveling on a subway and seeing the faces of these guys who are deeply linked to cosmetics industries. And so I think the notion that below these genre forms that don't necessarily seem to, I don't think they're necessarily blurring that much. Like, they're still quite distinct versions of Wong Jing comedy. Like, there's a distinct type of Hong Kong comedy that still exists in a certain way. There's a distinct type of action film. But then sort of existing just below this is a whole genre of what it means to be beautiful and the genre of those men. I don't know if that's a long response.
It's like a new, the kind of consumer culture of the massive development of these markets comes to kind of,
But I don't know if, and I guess I have to admit I know more about these K-pop stars in the context of, even if some of them from mainland China, in the context of Korean cinema. But there aren't as many films as you would imagine that are about K-pop or about K-pop worlds. As in, like, when Lu Han goes, like, leaves the pop music world and goes to mainland China, he's often in very conventional comedies or romances that aren't about consumer culture. There might be something like 20 Once Again. It's very, very nostalgic for Shanghai in the 1930s, and so it isn't. I guess this is the thing that they're beautiful, and there's a certain type of beauty that's imagined to be very mobile, but it doesn't mean that there's a whole genre of films that's emerging around these types of men. It's more that they're just kind of being slotted into an existing storyline. There's a new type of love interest. There's a new type of younger brother. there's a new type of bass player, but it's. I guess this is why I find it interesting that actually these existing genre forms that have different assumptions about masculinity are absolutely carrying on as they always were. And K-pop is not having a narrative influence, even if the shapes of faces are changing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you've all got lots of questions and things to follow up.
Okay. Because it's off topic where you speaking about now, the idea of this new masculinity, and you mentioned this soft pan-Asian masculinity, which you're talking about, these K-pop types, which are kind of feminine and cute, beautiful as subjective or whatever you would say. So I like this idea that you said they're kind of like apprentice to the hegemonic masculinity of the traditional, so-called maybe old-school masculinity of the tough guys. So I wonder if in these films, can you see that they might be, what would be a word, pushed or picked on or looked down, maybe in some sort of hierarchy and things that make you think that they're going to graduate from being cute to being masculine in an old style sense? Can you see these plot lines or things that happen, perhaps through dialogue or gestures? And maybe you said as well, you didn't get to speak too much about the idea of vulnerability. Mm. Maybe that's what's vulnerable.
Mm.
That they're going to lose their soft masculinity and become eventually the traditional man, so to speak? Can you see these things?
Weirdly enough, I can't, but I can picture the type of, in a North American context, I can picture the storyline where there's a young guy being beaten up on by older guys. You know, maybe he looks a bit nerdy, and then by the end of the film, it turns out that he's super good looking, and that you know, gets the girl or whatever. I can picture that sort of storyline where a certain sort of softer masculinity is set up to be someone who's picked on or is more vulnerable, and then it becomes about how they overcome. I don't think that's, oddly enough, that doesn't seem to be the case in certainly not in the case with there are many young men now that that Jackie Chan is paired with in his movies, so it's really common. Although Jackie Chan does a huge amount of the action himself at it, like I don't think it's that his other people are doing more fighting than him necessarily, but he is often playing someone who is a teacher or has some sort of fatherly role. But I don't actually think that in those movies, the sense that they would be picked on or they would be particularly vulnerable is a key feature. In The Great Wall, there's a little bit of that. So the character played by Lu Han, at a certain point, like, he's just not very good at fighting, and he's not as good at Matt Damon as fighting, and then Matt Damon kind of saves him. But that example is hard to talk about too much because we really don't see much of Lu Han, and I'd probably just prefer to say that in that case, it is about having the attraction. It's about having, like as an attraction in the film, to say, well, Lu Han is in this film, and it kind of just signals that this isn't just for action movie buffs or Zhang Yimou buffs, but that this is sort of tapping into what younger people might be consuming. So yeah, just as an answer to your question, I think it's a really good question because it's like this, that's a type of storyline that you would expect to see more often. You expect to see the vulnerable young man, and you don't see that quite so much. It seems to be, it's almost like it's odd that it isn't more uncomfortable and there isn't this clash between different types of masculinity.
So the roles yeah. accepted as is, and they will continue to play these types of roles for the next. I guess it's such a new thing. I'm not familiar with this kind of K-pop, that sort of thing. So, is there anybody that's quite graduated from being, you know, in their early 20s and maybe now in their early 30s or 40s that has come from this type of background that's doing these kind of things?
The person who would be eligible for that I can think of is Rain. Mm. And for some reason, and I actually don't know enough about what has happened to Rain's career, and so it becomes a little bit anecdotal. So he did move from being a K-pop star of an earlier generation to being in a series of action films. They weren't particularly successful, but they played him as a really tough, I mean, you know, he's a very fit guy, so they just played him as a tough action hero. And for whatever reason, they were not films that were well pitched, and so he didn't have a lot of success. I don't know if you could say that success was because there wasn't enough of an understanding of how to balance him needing to be a good-looking guy with actually some of the much more rough and violent films that you get from South Korea that are about male action heroes, because a lot of the South Korean films, a lot of the ones that are about masculinity are super violent, and Rain hasn't been in any of the thrillers. So maybe there were problems there, but I wouldn't want to overstate the case of Rain.
And maybe one reason why you can't overstate it or it doesn't become so tense is that soft masculinity and hard masculinity are both traditional, both really, really ancient. So it isn't like, oh, there's a new soft thing. Say in the Chinese version, Wen and Wu, Mo and Man, one is the literary effete scholar and the other is the, you know, the warrior, but they're both masculine. There's no room for the feminine at all in that thing. And generally speaking, somebody who is all martial art and no softness and no culture and no literacy is going to die. You know, so the ideal hero traditionally in that culture has both. So I think what you actually said was they're serving an apprenticeship to a hard masculinity rather than a hegemonic or traditional at the end. And so probably what's new is the K-pop sort of twist on the soft cultured masculine. Yeah. Has anybody seen these films? Nobody? No. Why not?
I looked at Great Wall the other day at the video store and I was like, oh, I don't want to put myself through this, but I'm really curious now.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I mean, I said to Tim, like, I haven't yet, I always intend to, but I haven't seen Great Wall and I haven't seen Kung Fu Yoga because they're so abject to Chinese and Indian critics that I read and I'm friends with. But this is a really, you know, I mean, that clip got me straight away. You know, I don't care. That was fabulous. So that's really important because.
Can I ask a query about soft power soft power from the Chinese perspective? My interpretation of the Great Wall was that, I was interpreting it from the other perspective. You know, you're going to bring Matt Damon, Hollywood star, in. He's going to become kind of your action hero, embody. I haven't seen the film, so I can't really speak to this, but this was my kind of understanding of, you know, embodying American values to some degree, you know, Hollywood American values. So I'm wondering whether or not you could speak to that. Like, does it subvert that in some ways?
So I think it's hard partly because the film explicitly says, like, him and the character played by Pedro Pascal as well are from somewhere in Europe, and they've been soldiers for hire, so they've been mercenaries. And so in a way it's not that different. Like, in terms of the storyline, it's also very, very similar to the Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns of the 1960s. So it's like the people who come from out of town to make a buck, and then slowly they realize that they're getting sucked into the more profound moral drama of civilization versus the wilderness, which in this particular case is monsters from the north. But calling that an American, it's hard to call that a set of a, like, I think probably North American audiences might sort of, if they're familiar with the Clint Eastwood films or the way that that's been reworked, think, okay, well, this is about American values versus Chinese values. I'd be very surprised. That's certainly not the main criticism or concern of the critics of the reviews, at least, that I read in the Chinese context, although I don't read Chinese, so I can only read the English versions. Because there are lots of stories also within the wuxia genre about knight errants who travel from place to place and form loyalties, and often quite provisional loyalties.
Yes. And foreigners who came through China, it's common.
I would totally take it that people would think it's readable as a American values plus Chinese tradition makes for good protecting of the wall. You know, like that, you could have a really simple formula that some audiences might.
They might, yeah. But I think it's going to be mostly sort of progressive critics, you know. And if I could just say, because I brought drag soft power into it, but what I'm saying is that Chinese production is one step ahead of us now. I mean, they don't care. We care. That's our problem. That's not their problem. Their problem is how to make global movies that are genuinely popular. And if this is one way, see if it works. So, yes, like that wince, but that is about us and our political background or our critical background.
I guess another point, sorry, I'm going to riff on that comment and also your comment. Another point that seems really important from the viewpoint of North American critics, but I also actually think is a point of difference and tension within some commentary on Bollywood and some commentary on mainland Chinese cinema, is whether capitalism or evidence of commerce is read as a Western presence and how that's politicized. Because of course you can actually talk about histories of trades and market-based exchanges between, like, within China, but also between China and India, and then in the history of India. So it's not as though markets or people who are interested in commerce and travel and trade are exclusively Western. But at the same time, it does matter that some of the immediate signifiers of being a wealthy trader, so in the context of Kung Fu Yoga, the Randall character, will be about wearing certain sorts of suits and having certain things that where it is actually tapping into certain sorts of consumer culture that get linked to North American embodiments of wealth and affluence. So I think I don't have anything strong to say in either direction, but I would say that it's actually an active question as to whether the presence of capitalism commerce or Jackie Chan's constant criticism of capitalism commerce gets, you know, whether that can be just turned into an easy allegory for the West is sort of impeding on national culture. And I actually think a lot of films do something slightly more complicated that's about trying to look at tensions that might be long-running tensions within a country about what the role is of entrepreneurs and of people who travel between places, because they're often also the people who've got a lot of different cultural literacies. The people who travel and trade are also people who move between different cultural spaces. And so I guess that's why I find it interesting. I don't think it's enough just to say that they're mercenaries or that they're just capitalists. I don't think that really maps what's at stake there.
Have you seen the recent, like, the Chinese blockbuster, which is actually one of the biggest box office, like, in history? It's the Wolf Warrior.
That's what we were talking about.
Yeah, so I just wonder, because it's tried to create this kind of, you know, masculinity, that it seemed to be a backlash against this Rohan style, I don't know how that was called. And it's also reflect, like, it's different from other state-sanctioned, you know, very nationalistic films, because it seems like quite independent, like it doesn't have any sponsorship from some kind of state organizations. But it is some kind of very nationalistic film, and it actually occurred like in other continents, like the recent one in Africa. So I read all this kind of film critics, and this, you know, one of them is this kind of a misrepresentation of what Africa is like in the popular imaginary of the Chinese. So I'm not sure, like, how do you, like, in terms of the masculinity, the discussion of it, like, how do you fit this new film, which is much more popular than the Great War among the Chinese audience?
I have made attempts to download it, and it's people sitting in the cinema doing that for me to get the versions that have the English subtitles. So there's a, but I have attempted to.
What's it called?
Wolf Warrior 2.
Yeah. Maybe have to wait a bit.
The only thing I could offer at this point would be just to go back to that point that you've made in your work, but also that S.V. Srinivas makes about the politics of the stereotype also having to be linked to this sense of vernacular consumer cultures and histories of consumer exchange, and that I would probably just want to err towards treating representations of it's people from mainland China going and saving some children in Africa. There's some kind of situation, and I can't remember, I don't even know if they say in the description of the film where in Africa, but that already sort of tells us maybe something. But I guess I would just want to say that one of the differences there is not just, is this an accurate representation of Africa as a continent compared with accurate representations of India, but to think, well, actually what it means for there to be stereotypes to circulate in relation to Africa, where African popular cultures are not being consumed in mainland China in anywhere near the same volume, that would matter. That's all I can say.
But that's interesting too, given the amount of soft and economic power that's happening in Africa.
Absolutely.
You know, so
it's not a
primitivist foray, obviously.
That's the major axis. I mean, as we saw in Australia in Perth, A few months ago, where the African delegates joined the PRC delegates in interrupting the welcome to country because a member of the Taiwan delegation had foolishly been invited. You know, it's China and Africa is the major emerging alliance of the future, which is not mapped by the past. I think that's very important. And I don't know if you know Raymond Zhang. He's one of our students from Hong Kong. He just posted an article in Chinese from Ming Pao on Wolf Warrior. I can't read it, but I'll send you the clip. But I said, what did you say, Raymond? And he said, basically that what was new about it was the middle classness of the values, the urban middle class consumer version of patriotism, which was not like, you know, the old communist patriotism, but a new kind of middle class thing. And I thought, well, that's not very satisfying. I want to see the film and read the article. But it's going to be very interesting to see how it does. It has not done well in the USA. It flopped because they don't want to see a Chinese hero playing that type of masculine hero, you know. But I think it's quite likely to do well in Africa, maybe, and in India and in Australia and everywhere.
Yeah, I might have to go to the cinema to see it.
Yeah.
That'll be exciting.
And I can really recommend Kong Skull Island. I mean, you know, I've seen all the Kong films. I wrote a lot about King Kong a long time ago. But there's one extraordinary moment which is just almost breathtaking in what I cannot not perceive as racism. Right, because Samuel Jackson is the evil, psychotic American militarist who wants to kill Kong because Kong has killed some of his men and we never leave our men unavenged. Mm-hmm. And everyone's starting to tell him, you're a psychopath, you've totally lost it. And there is this close-up of Samuel Jackson's black face and his eyes, and the next shot is a close-up of Kong. It's like, I don't believe I saw that. But then I think, well, yeah, but I come with a cultural, historical baggage that makes me see that.
As an animalist, I see it differently.
You see it differently, right? So there is that moment. But apart from that, there are, you know, everybody who's not an American tough guy, including all the animals, except for the raptors who are out of Jurassic Park. Everybody's good, you know, except for the crazy Apocalypse Now American. And I think, yeah, well, Chinese soft power, that's nice. But it is fascinating, and it's really well made, and it's pulled up all this stuff out of Avatar and mixed it up very explicitly with two or three other blockbusters.
Seems like a good okay. to finish on.
Yes. Well.
thank you for jumping in as well.
Thank you for listening to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork, like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies, and visit us at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.